Welcome to episode 3 of the Service Course Report. All three of us are here in Carpinteria, California, where we've spent a lot of time growing up. I'm Ed Philbrick, and I'm joined by Kurt Stockton and Darren Stockton. What are the vibes here in Carpinteria, California?
Dude, the vibes are great in Carpinteria, California. I can tell you, as I've been living here for 6 years, and the vibes are good weather we're having, summer weather, great riding, low key, not a lot of packed in traffic. It's awesome.
Yeah, I would say that summer weather here is quite pleasant. It's been in the low to mid 70s every day. Slight breeze, a lot of sunshine. Well, that's why people live on the Central Coast.
Great riding weather. What's
Yeah.
your take on the vibes, Ed?
Well, we did a great ride. We did two of them actually on the Carpinteria Bluffs and then behind Summerlin, Ortega area, areas that have quite an extensive network of trails, horseback trails. But Aaron led the way, and we looped around the Carpinteria Bluffs under the eucalyptus trees on areas that were preserved. We zipped through town a couple of times, and the trails back behind Ortega and Summerlin, those weren't really there in the time of Summerlin cycles, which was the late 80s, early 90s. We used to go out there and see if we could demo mountain bikes, and probably early mountain bikes suspension hadn't quite come.
Right.
And
Those
those
trails
trails
were
were
pockmarked
pockmarked
with
with
horses
horses or
or
kind
kind
of
of
adobe style
adobe-style clay.
clay. I
Didn't
didn't really
really
experience
experience
that
that
yesterday.
yesterday.
We
We
kind
kind
of
of
float
float
around
around
through
through
the
the
orange
orange
groves
groves
and
and
up
up
and
and
around
around
Summerlin.
Summerlin.
I'm
I'm
pretty
pretty
tired.
tired.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Yeah,
truth
truth
be
be
told,
told,
our
our
plan
plan
was
was
to
to
record
record
this
this
podcast
podcast
yesterday
yesterday
after
after
we
we
rode,
rode,
but
but
we
we
were
were
all
all
too
too
flogged
flogged
out
out
after
after
riding
riding
yesterday.
yesterday.
So
So
we
we
agreed
agreed
to
to
fall
fall
back
back
and
into
do
it
it
today.
today.
So
So that's
that's good
good
though.
though.
Yeah,
All of
our
our
legs
legs
were
were
blasted,
blasted,
which
which
is
is
an
an
awesome
awesome
day.
day.
Well, and
And
it
it
was
was
great
great
that
that
we actually
actually
got
got
out
out
to
to
ride
ride
together,
together,
and
and
we
we
ended
ended
up
up
being
being
out
out
about
about
4 hours,
4 hours,
I
I
think.
think.
And
And yeah.
the
The
last
last
time
time
we
we
rode
rode
together
together
was
was
back
back
in
in
February
February
when
when
we
we
were
were
at
at
the
the
Rock
Rock
Cobbler.
Cobbler.
So
So
it's
it's
been
been
a
a
little
little
while,
while,
you
you
know.
know.
We're
We're
at
at
the
the
end
end
of
of
July
July
now.
now.
So,
So,
wow.
wow.
Got
Got
to
to
cherish
cherish
those
those
moments
moments
when
when
we're
we're
together
together
and
and
riding.
riding.
So
So
that
that
was
was
really
really
cool
cool
to
to
be
be
able
able
to
to
do
do
a
a
little
little
bit
bit
more
more
of
of
that.
that.
Yeah,
Yeah,
and
and
the
the
three
three
of
of
us
us
have
have
ridden
ridden
together.
together.
We
We
were
were
trying
trying
to
to
do
do
some
some
loose
loose
calculations,
calculations,
but
but
you
you
know,
know,
in
in
the
the
tens
tens
of
of
thousands
thousands
of
of
miles
miles
together
together
over
over
our
our
lifetime,
lifetime,
more
more
when
when
we
we
were
were
younger
younger
because
because
we
we
all
all
grew
grew
up
up
here
here
and
and
were
were
riding
riding
road
road
bikes
bikes
and
and
you
you
know,
know,
and
and
did
did
that
that
before
before
we
we
moved
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 separate
separate
ways.
ways.
But
But
it's
it's
pretty
pretty
fun
fun
going
going
out
out
and
and
just
just
riding
riding
with
with
people
people
who
who
you
you
just
just
know
know
their
their
riding
riding
styles
styles
and
and
trust
trust
them.
them.
You're
You're
not
not
worried
worried
if
if
they're
they're
going
going
to
to
do
do
anything
anything
squirrely.
squirrely.
That's
That's
a
a
great
great
part
part
of
of
riding
riding
for
for
the
the
three
three
of
of
us.
us.
And
And
also
also
my
my
buddy
buddy
Jonah
Jonah
was
was
out
out
with
with
us
us
yesterday
yesterday
as
as
well.
well.
Who's
Who's
also
also
another
another
great
great
low-key
low-key
ride
ride
partner,
partner,
you
you
know,
know,
to,
to,
for
for
me,
me,
I
I
know
know
my
my
life
life
is
is
so
so
packed
packed
and
and
tight
tight
and
and
busy
busy
that
that
the
the
last
last
thing
thing
I
I
need
need
to
to
do
do
if
if
I'm
I'm
just
just
waking
waking
up
up
and
and
doing
doing
a
a
ride
ride
on
on
my
my
own
own
time
time
on
on
a
a
day
day
with
with
no
no
clients
clients
or
or
anything
anything
where
where
I
I
feel
feel
like
like
stressed
stressed
and
and
rushed.
rushed.
So
So
it's
it's
kind
kind
of
of
nice
nice
when
when
we
we
have
have
a
a
low-key
low-key
ride
ride
that
that
we
we
get
get
up
up
and
and
we're
we're
like,
like,
hey,
hey,
we're
we're
shooting
shooting
to
to
leave
leave
by
by
this
this
time,
time,
but
but
if
if
it
it
rolls
rolls
a
a
little
little
bit
bit
later,
later,
it's
it's
not
not
a
a
big
big
deal.
deal.
So
So
that's
that's
another
another
fun
fun
part
part
of
of
me
me
for
for
doing
doing
the
the
rides
rides
with
with
us.
us.
None
None
of
of
us
us
are
are
so
so
stressed
stressed
out
out
about
about
it
it
that
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 we're
we're
sticking
sticking
to
to
a
a
specific
specific
timeline
timeline
or
or
anything.
anything.
Yeah,
Yeah,
and
and
then
then
we
we
had
had
the
the
ultimate
ultimate
urban
urban
gravel
gravel
tour
tour
of
of
the
the
Carpinteria
Carpinteria
Summerlin
Summerlin
area.
area.
And
And
so
so
even
even
that
that
you
you
get
get
out
out
and
and
you
you
get
get
on
on
these
these
cool
cool
little
little
trails
trails
and
and
these
these
connectors
connectors
and
and
all
all
this
this
stuff,
stuff,
but
but
you're
you're
never
never
too
too
far
far
from
from
anything
anything
too.
too.
Right?
Right.
So
So
we
we
got
got
to
to
the
the
point
point
where
where
like,
like,
yeah,
yeah,
we're gonna go
go
back
back
to
to
the
the
studio.
studio.
Jonah
Jonah
was
was
a
a
little
little
bit
bit
hungry.
hungry.
Well,
Well,
hey,
hey,
we
we
can
can
stop
stop
and
and
get
get
a
a
snack
snack
really
really
quickly.
quickly.
We're
We're
right
right
there,
there,
but
but
we're
we're
not
not
too
too
far
far
from
from
the
the
riding.
riding.
It's
It's
like
like
you
you
don't
don't
have
have
to
to
deviate
deviate
from
from
your
your
program
program
too
too
much,
much,
which
which
was
was
really
really
cool.
cool.
Yeah,
Yeah,
you're
you're
never
never
way
way
out
out
if
if
something
something
happens.
happens.
I
I
think
think
the
the
furthest
furthest
we
we
ever
ever
were
were
yesterday
yesterday
was
was
about
about
20
20
minutes,
minutes,
20,
twenty,
25
25
minutes
minutes
from
from
being
being
back
back
at
at
my
my
shop.
shop.
Yeah,
Yeah,
it
it
was
was
really
really
cool
cool
to
to
see
see
the
the
prosperity
prosperity
of
of
Carpinteria.
Carpinteria.
Like,
Like,
we
we
stopped
stopped
at
at
a
a
health
health
food
food
store.
store.
Jonah
Jonah
had
had
a
a
quinoa
quinoa
wrap
wrap
and
and
$6.99
$6.99
chocolate
chocolate
balls
balls
and
and
that
that
he
he
handed
handed
out
out
to
to
us
us
that
that
were
were
worth
worth
every
every
penny
penny
we
we
deduced.
deduced.
And
And
there
there
was
was
a
a
gentleman
gentleman
playing
playing
his
his
kazoo
kazoo
and
and
his
his
ukulele
ukulele
in
in
an
an
outfit.
outfit.
And
And
you know, Carpinteria is thriving. There's, you know, new businesses, and we went to another, well, I don't know, it was Honey Coffee
Santa
Shop,
Barbara Hives.
Santa Barbara Hives. Yeah, so
Yeah.
it was great.
Yeah.
You know, Carpinteria has had its times of a rusty pizza chain and not much else going on, and the
Yeah,
Frosted
it's
Freeze
freeze
that's
that's gone.
gone.
Yeah, it's great to see that side of it, you know, really pick up in all the shops, like you were saying.
You know, one of the ride areas that we started off in out on the Carpinteria Bluffs, the very uppermost area of that is this area, we still call it Thunderbowl, which used to be called Thunderbowl way back, and we went out and rode our dirt bikes out there. So it used to kind of be our bootleg riding area, and so it's kind of cool when I go out there on my gravel bike, and all of us yesterday, but I go out and ride, I'm hitting the same rollers and jumps on my gravel bike today that I was doing on my YZ125 with the Bob Hurricane Hanna seat on it back in like the 70s, actually, you know, early 80s, I think was probably maybe the last time we ever rode out there. So it's just pretty fun for me to see an area that I've ridden out there with my friends over the years. They had a race series for a while, the Avocado Pit Dirt Crit out there, which I competed in, a little local series. And so it's just fun to know that that riding area has morphed over the years and has actually been bought by the Nature Conservancy in Carpinteria, so it can never be developed, those trails or those trails forever, which is really nice.
Well, yeah, and another quick thing too is the wind that comes up off those bluffs, you get the kite sailors out there.
Yeah.
Right? It's an ultimate lot, like where we're riding right at the top, which was used to be the top of Thunderbowl, like where you'd go park and stuff when you took your motor out there with a kid. Now people go up there and they basically fly right off of there on their kites and just sail back and forth. Yeah, if you're ever coming up 101, coming into Rincon there, oftentimes, especially in the afternoon when the wind's up a little more, you see people flying out there. So that's that was really cool to see.
Yeah.
And thinking about that. You know, I laughed as we were riding along the train tracks yesterday. I remember we used to go to Thunderbowl, and then we're like, hey, you can get down to the train tracks, and then we could, like, scoot north or scoot toward town a little bit and go ride that other part of Thunderbowl where that driving range is now, which we weren't supposed to ride at, but we're like, well, if anybody chases you, you can always just get down to the train tracks and escape them. So,
That was a sandy track over there where the driving range is now. It went in and out of the eucalyptus trees. That's right. I kind of even forgot about that, all the riding along there.
And then it sounded like someone was having a heavy metal concert there yesterday.
It was fun to do the hot laps through. You know, we kind of looped around. We took some photos and video and so forth. And we saw all the key elements. There's Rincon. There's the Clean Sea Pier, which, you know, comes from the 1972 oil spill. And the oil companies put together a consortium where they all had to chip in and pay to keep the oil spills under control. And a gentleman named Rick Gill, who we all grew up, was, you know, ran that operation. We went by that. We went by tar pits, which really is a tar pit. Jonah put his S-Fire Shimano shoes in the tar pit, which I thought was great because I would try really hard to avoid it, but he's the local and so he should know that tar pit. He hit it, ruined his shoes.
Both of his shoes.
His shoes were tarred and feathered, or tarred and leaved, whatever you want to say.
Tarred and leaved and sanded, yeah. Yeah, he was pretty not pleased with that.
Yeah, so we did the tar pits, and then we rode through the campground, and I was like, wow, the campground is thriving.
Yeah, State Beach.
We rode the bike trail on the north end of town. You know, we all grew up as kids around Santa Claus Lane, and some people might remember Santa Claus Lane. It is gone. It's quite bougie and fancy, and but there's a spectacular bike path on the north end of town headed towards Summerlin, you know, past where Bill Clinton spent his first nights as an inaugurated president or about to be president. So there's just like a lot of history that we passed through. And, you know, we rode behind Summerlin, Cycles, where we all, you know, tested early mountain bikes, which I started our story about.
Yeah. The old MB1s we had. Well, I'm curious for the you two, if you had to pick out like one stoke of doing the gravel riding, because it's all pretty new terrain for all of you. You know, for me, obviously, I've been riding this stuff for, you know, for several years now. I'm riding around. I kind of found all these trails during COVID, during lockdown, and I was just looking for places to ride that I could ride from the home and start exploring all of these. And then Jonah, actually, his sister, Bettina, was big in the equestrian side of things. There's a lot of horse property and horse riding properties up there, and so he knew a lot of trails that he had found from her, and we kind of had our meeting of the minds at one point, and I'm like, check out all the stuff out on the bluffs, and he's like, dude, we got to go behind Summerlin, look at all these new trails. And it really blew my mind out there riding on all those. But I'll say, for me, my biggest stoke is showing friends new trails. So it was cool for me to have you guys out there and really dig in and show you all the trails and stuff that Jonah and I ride on all the time. I'll go out during the wintertime because the dirt doesn't really hold up in the summertime if you try and dig it or do anything. But in the wintertime when there's good rain, I'll go out there with my shovel and build some features, a few little, you know, a little kicker to jump down something or a little berm to blast. So it's fun for us to get out there. It was for me and show you guys my trail. So that's my biggest stoke for me of having you guys riding here is getting to show you new areas to ride on. So I don't know what your guys' biggest stoke was about the ride.
I would say it's a toss-up between doing repeat circuits out at Thunderball. Yeah, because when Ed and I were riding with you and John, we were like, okay, so this is we just did this one, or we did it two times or three times or five times. And then, like, you guys, we go down, we go off the first little drop and through the first corner, and you're out of sight. I'm like, oh, these guys have only done this, like, 700 times.
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool. And then I always still marvel at the connectors off of Toro Canyon that get you over to Ortega Hill on dirt the entire time. I mean, yeah, there's a little, some access roads for some of the properties there, you know, through the orchards. And it's really cool how they have the trail network, you know, basically along the property lines that I think, to your point, what you're saying, DS, that, you know, the equestrian crew had put that stuff in, but they are multi-use. So, you know, you're watching out for rocks and you're watching out for piles of horse crap at the same time, you know, so you got features or, you know, things to get around, but that just cool. And just how much is right there that, you know, Highway 101's a few hundred yards or a quarter mile away and you just don't even know it. So that part's pretty, both of those. Very cool.
What about you, Ed?
For me, it's riding along the ocean and staying cool. Like, you know, you can ride Torrey Pines on the paved road. You can ride in Laguna maybe on some trails. But where in Southern California, except for moving to Central Pismo, can you ride overlooking the ocean? Yeah. We took some really great photos with the ocean in the background. And then at the same time, it's a little bit like Valencia, Spain. We were riding through orange or lemon groves. And then all of a sudden we pop out and we're on a manicured polo ground, you know, that was like, looked like lawn bowling. It was smooth.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it was fun and all the locals were friendly and it's not very ridden. Like if that was San Diego or Orange County, there would have been 50 cyclists. And we ran into one gentleman and he goes, those bikes are not supposed to be off road. And then a little later in town in Carpinteria, he was sitting in a restaurant and goes, oh, it's you guys again.
Yeah. That was pretty funny.
Yeah.
Saw that guy.
Small town.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, so cool. It's just really good to be back all together in person. We were roommates here in Carpinteria at the Franciscan Village during our racing days.
That's right.
We did some circuit racing inside the complex on tandems and other non-essential bicycles.
Yeah.
So rounding out kind of a theme of our podcast is technology and bike tech. And so we're going to have like a weekly service course tech tip. And I thought we would talk a little bit about something that litters the internet and Instagram and your ads. And there must be 50 products out there right now, these little electronic pumps.
Yeah.
So I ordered mine. I think I paid $165 from Silica. Sorry for mispronouncing it. I always mispronounce it. And it has a gauge. It's interesting. So we both were sort of testing them yesterday and over the last 2 days. It works great on road tires for me. It, you know, you set the pressure, you want 60 PSI, and it clicks off at that PSI ideally. But what we're finding is that clogged valves kind of give erroneous click-offs, and so it thinks it's reached a pressure that it hasn't. They're super loud. And they get hot.
Very loud.
I was going to turn mine on.
Sounds like a weed whacker or something, right?
So mine is not quite as loud as
a little two-stroke
KS's.
Yeah.
I kind of give up when I'm doing my mountain bike tires. I think it's just not getting the PSI that, you know, I'm trying to reach 25 or 30 PSI and I'm clicking off at 17, at 20. my road tires, like I said, it goes perfectly to 60 or 65 or where, whatever I'm after. You know, and rounding out the conversation on this product was coming to market, you know, heavily advertised, and then they decided it wasn't going to be in the U.S. because of the tariffs. So there was a very few that ever hit the market. Well, then 2 months later, it did hit the market, maybe at a higher price. I don't know. What are your experiences with yours, Kaz?
So I have the Prestacycle, Prestaflator Go, which I think it launched about the same time last spring. I think maybe late February into March. And I was out at the Philly Bike Expo in March. And Prestacycle had a booth there, and I saw that thing, and I was like, I'd kind of heard about these things. I've seen a couple on Kickstarter. I was riding out with when I was doing stuff at the Hoppers. Lance Hyatt was out there, and he had one that was like a Kickstarter one. I'm like, what is that, dude? And he goes, check it out. And pumped up someone's tire with it. Oh, it's not available yet, and we'll do it. And this one came out, and so I was like, I saw it at the Philly Bike Expo, and I go, that's actually pretty cool. You know, and it's small enough that I can throw it in my pocket. And it's a, I wouldn't use it as a replacement. I mean, we'll talk about what we carry with us. This is something that I do carry with me. It doesn't hit hard enough, like if your tire debeads, but it's great for filling up. I mean, the only thing that I found is that it tends to read a little bit low. So like, I have another gauge that I check my tires with, and I have a pump that has a gauge on it. And if I set my tire at 20, you know, I put this thing at 25. It's actually at 27 on my other ones, but that's pretty easy if it's two PSI off. I don't know which one is actually correct, but you can just adjust because it's more important that you use the same gauge rather than
that's it.
Right. For consistency versus, oh, I always got to have a certain PSI. Well, if you're changing gauges around, you don't know if those gauges are consistent. So I enjoy the thing. I do put it, I have a little bag that I put it in when I put it in my pocket because I find that I, you know, when you're route riding, it does get some moisture just from sweating because it's up against your back. But so far, so good. And it's pretty cool. You know, it uses their head here and then that thing, it does thread out. So it can be smaller. But if you're familiar with Prestacycle and the stuff they do, they've got a bunch of interchangeability. I have no affiliation with Prestacycle other than my friend Dan Larch is an ambassador, and he did give me a discount code for a purchase, so I did purchase it, and it seems pretty cool. Yeah. And it does. It has a digital gauge. I'm not going to turn it on because, as I mentioned, it's louder than the one he had, which they're plenty loud, so just take our word on it on that. But, right, so we both have one DS-Knot, but then this it got us thinking, like, okay, well, what do you carry? Like, yeah. Right? We used to always have a frame pump, right? And then pumps got smaller, and then CO2s, and that was, oh, just triathletes. But, like, so, like, what do you got in your kit, DS? Yeah. What do you carry with you? Not only, like
yeah.
The ride kit.
Yeah. What's in my bag? So I'll bring up what I have in my bag. And it's funny, which also brings up another topic about what's in your bag, is it's good to periodically check what's in your bag, because when I checked mine today, I realized I was missing my 11-speed quick link, which if you break a chain out there, but I have a spare tube, a vinyl tube, a Panaracer one. I have my Pro multi-tool, which this one I found is great. I don't remember the model of it, but it has a chain brake on it, which is really nice, and it fits in. It has all the Allen keys that you need, Torx and everything. So I have that. I have a single tire lever. I love these Park ones with the plastic and then the little metal tip on there. I find these are great. You can get it in and move it around.
They don't break when you're in.
They don't
most,
break. Yeah, never, spot. ever broken one. I do put my, I have a little mini pump inside of there. So if I have an issue and my quick fill can't fix it, or you run out of quick fills or something, which will happen sometimes if you flat a tubeless and you try and plug it, and then you're filling up with air, and for some reason it doesn't beat up, you could find yourself out of quick fill. So I always have this mini pump, and I bought this one because it would fit inside my Explorer seat pack. Now I have, on my Mondraker bike, it has in-tube storage, so I was able to get rid of my pack, which I'm really stoked about. But this little mini one would fit in my pack, so I didn't have to carry it in my pocket. And then I have a quick fill. And the inflator, this is a 20 gram. So I get a couple uses out of it. Oops, sorry about that microphone. And then my last one, I have a, this is a Lasagna plug, the bacon strip. So that thing unscrews and I have some extras in there. I have one preloaded. So if you get the flat, you know, you can put it right in there. And so that, and then the last two, like I said, I didn't have my quick link in there, which I'll have to remember to go down and get one. I don't know if it fell out or I forgot to put one in when I had my new bike, my quick link. And there was one other one. Oh, and then the last one is, you know, we used to carry, like for road bikes, a little boot, a piece of tire, because if you get a big slash in your tire, you can boot it. But I've found over the years that a good old-fashioned American dollar bill works the best. But I normally put two singles in my toolkit, and I didn't have those in there either, but I do have a backup 20 I always carry with me with my insurance card. So if you do get a slash that's too big to fix, you can line the inside of that with a dollar bill or whatever you might have at the moment. 20 is a little pricey, but, you know, so that's what's in my kit.
Yeah, well, I would say that, and that boot's super important, right? Because if you get a hole that you can't plug, then you got to put a tube in, but you can't have the tube poking back out or else... Yeah,
100%.
You're doing a lot of walking.
Yeah. All right, Ed. What's in your bag, baby?
So, we kind of thought of this topic. I was telling the story about I got a flat the other day, and I got back to the brewery, and everyone was talking about it, and I just hauled out my bag, and I'm like, oh, I wonder what's really in there.
Yeah.
As DS mentioned, it's always a good idea to take a look. So I have a Bontrager lightweight multi-tool. This is for my road bike, by the way. I have two Continental tire levers. I have a Tubalito. Always good to check. Make sure you have the correct length valve. Nothing worse
yes.
than being on the side of the road and your valve isn't quite long enough.
That's a long valve. This is must be your road seat pack, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have my Dynaplug.
Tubeless fixer, for those who don't know what it is. Tubeless plug.
Yep. $65 tubeless plug. I have two CO2s. I wrap them in duct tape in case the duct tape might help with something. And it cuts down on the rattling. I'm big on cutting down on the noise. Then here's my lightweight. I don't know who makes it.
Inflator head.
I'm sure that I purchased this based on weight.
Based on weight.
Topic for another car.
Nice.
What I noticed was there's no dollar bill, which is not a good idea. There's no chain link. I do have my AirTag, but I'm not even sure how, you know, AirTags don't last forever, so I'm not sure even if it's activated. And then I keep everything in a pretty small, almost air bag.
It's pretty svelte.
Because I don't like my large thighs dragging on my seat bag and tearing up my shorts.
Right.
Yeah.
How about you, Kaz?
Well, what you guys have, I mean, I'm looking at my stuff here. I carry two tubes. The vinyl types, I do have tubalitas. I would add one little thing. I take mine and I put them in a little Ziploc to protect them from the elements if you're riding, especially in the winter. But also... You can find one stuff. You're talking about like the CO2s rattling. If they rattle around, you get that aluminum dust. It just keeps these tubes clean because if not, and they're very, you know, they can, last thing you need is to pull it out and have not have it hold air. Of course, I do have a multi-tool. It's a Crank Brothers. It may be very well from, and I don't care about weight. This may very well be from the Crank Brothers sponsorship, the Sierra Nevada team days, which was like a couple decades ago, but you know, it still works.
Testament to the tool.
Absolutely. Folds down small. I do carry a boot. We were talking yesterday, or I was in DS's studio, like what's the use of a 700 by 23 tire anymore? Well, if you have any laying around, you can cut a section out and take the, cut the bead out. And that's something that comes in handy if you have to tube a tubeless tire. I do have a separate little chain breaker because I don't have one on the multi-tool. I do have a spare link in there, a speed link. I don't bother to carry a CO2. CO2 is on our ride because I have that. Especially once I got the Press Deflator, I'm like, okay, I've got that for more effortless plugging up. But I also I carry a larger pump that goes onto the frame. I like this Lazine one. The biggest feature with this is it does. It's got a hose that threads in. Right, so the hose threads in when you air it up, but it's nice because it flexes, so you don't. Oftentimes, you can break. Nothing worse than breaking off a tubeless valve, which you can do that, or more often, sometimes you can just break the insert of the valve itself. And it has a little bleeder valve on it too, which is cool. So when you air it up, you can bleed off pressure. So I always carry the frame pump as just something extra to have, like DS mentioned, a backup. And then separately, I still ride with my phone. And so I got this phone case that I ride with in that little thing. Keep the insurance card. I ride, I just dropped it. I ride SRAM. So I always carry a spare CR2032 battery and then a quarter in there so I can turn the battery cover off and not wreck it. You know, always smart to carry your insurance card if you have it. Yeah. If you live where there's poison oak, a little tech new wipe. If you need to wipe the poison oak contact off, that's always
going to make for a much level there, better guess.
Next, yeah, not the other level. And then of course I keep my house key is in there on a tether, so I can get into my basement after ride. So this thing is nice. It has a full. It's this company Belroy out of Australia. Full waterproof zip on it. Phone fits in there. I've had previous versions of this once where I went over the bars. The phone bag was all scratched up and the phone survived. So, yeah.
Here.
That's it. Yeah, so that's the carry there.
Nice. So, that's a good stash. Maybe for a future one, we'll have to put them all on a scale and see how much actual weight we carry. Not that I'm too much of a weight weenie, but it is always interesting. You add a few things here, a few things there, and you can feel the weight.
When we were talking earlier about, you know, we all started with a lot heavier stuff on our bikes and bigger bags. I had a Kirkland bag with a metal rack that held the bag, and then the elastic went down to the fork to stabilize the bag. So, and now, you know, a lot of us are storing stuff in a SWAT box or down tube storage, and probably most every bike brand has that nowadays. But it's also like how quickly you can get to some of this stuff when you need it. Like those SWAT boxes, you can be hunting around in there. I was laughing because I pulled a hunting permit so that if I'm ever riding Bowden Canyon and I have that permit stuffed in my SWAT box. So like even though I probably shouldn't be riding, I'll have the permit there that might help me a little bit with my argument.
Right.
So
you have a legal right to be out there, even though you're just like hunting with your bare hands, basically.
Yeah, I probably should be walking my bike, carrying my rifle, but
yeah. Well, that's good.
And that reminds me too. One thing I didn't put there. You have that DynaPlug there. I actually have on my current build. I got the DynaPlug bar ends. So I don't have the bike sitting right here, but it's pretty cool. Each bar end. It's a little insert that you put into your handlebar, and then the DynaPlug, the plug holder, threads into each of the bar ends. So I've got two plugs in each bar end. We were talking about how you're talking about access to getting this stuff.
Right.
I think the most important thing for quick access is getting a plug. Because even if you can get your thumb over the hole so it's not shooting out all the air and all the sealant, you still have to be able to access your plug. And if it's like buried somewhere.
Yeah.
It kind of defeats the purpose, and that was a tip I got from a guy I worked with who does a bunch of these, I'm just doing a 1,500-kilometer race with no sleep type of thing, but they're racing for time, and he says he had his DynaPlug mounted right on the top of his handlebars or right on his top tube somewhere, so like if he got it, he instantly could grab it and use it, so... If time is of the essence or just, you know, getting that flat repaired quicker rather than being out there for a while goofing with it, that's one thing to consider is you know, how quickly you can access. And I think the most important thing, especially in the days of tubeless, is being able to access that plug.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. So you can get the plug in and save your air in there and get it sealed up. That's less pumping that you have to do. And yeah, that's a good tip, the easy access.
And even though it does sound like we're doing a lot, all you people who haven't gone to tubeless yet, you got to go tubeless. It's a game changer.
Yeah.
Right up there with clipless pedals and shifters and levers.
Yeah, I agree on that one. Yep. Yeah. All right, cool.
So one thought just crossed my mind. When I was walking the pits at Sea Otter, you know, you could see how all the pros mount their bacon strips on their brake lines.
Right. Just stick them.
The specialized pros had them because they don't have internal routing yet. They had their bacon strips stuck to their brake lines on the external. And then the like you were talking about, people putting their Dyna plugs in different locations. And I also saw that a lot of the riders are using both bacon strips and Dyna plugs there. Or, you know, doing two different techniques.
Uh-huh.
I guess the next subject was the Tour de France, everyone's favorite topic this time of year. But we thought we'd take a little bit different take on it and talk a little bit about some of the Tour fashion, colors, jerseys, the style that we're seeing out there. What do you see in DS?
Yeah, well, we're talking about, how much of accessorizing your jersey. If you're in a Tour Leaders jersey, right, you've got the yellow, the green, the polka dot, and then the white. How different people run it. Like, do you go full, if you're in yellow, are you full yellow top to bottom? Or do you just do traditional yellow jersey with black shorts? Or do you mix it up? And so I think it depends a little bit on a case-by-case basis. Like sometimes I'll think the polka dot, if you're top and bottom on the polka dot, that can maybe be a bit much because it's white, and I'm not a big fan of white shorts necessarily. The yellow, I think Tade, I think in UAE, they do a pretty good job on it. They have nice highlights on the bikes, different things like that. And so I tend to like them to go for it a little bit, even though I definitely have a traditional look on it. Like I don't mind a black short, but if it has some bands or even seeing guys in the full yellow or the green, I think top and bottom looks okay. But the polka dots might be a bit much if you're fully polka dotted. Then it depends on, do you do socks? Do you have your matching shades? Do you do it? But I like it all. It changes it up, you know. It's a different opportunity for us to see, you know, see the different sponsors' gear. So I like it.
What do you think about if you don't have the jersey, but it's on loan to you because you're in second and Todd is going to wear yellow and Martinez is going to wear the polka dot that day? So he isn't really rightfully the owner of it. You think he should have polka dot socks on that day?
I think if you got the jersey on, it's your right to do whatever you want with it. Accessorize to your heart's delight, bedazzle, put earrings, you know, do everything. Sorry, I'm wrestling with our Carpentry afternoon wind out here a little bit. I say go for it. Now, whether or not I like it or not is separate answer from that. But I think if you got the jersey on, whether you're in it or it's on loan, you can run it. Run it however you want. That's my take.
And I think it's just a brilliant marketing piece from the ASO. You know,
right.
Now that they have with the clothing sponsors, you know, they're making the kits, you know, they're literally sewing them up for the individual riders based on their measurements. It's not like the old days where they just had a jersey and stuck a sticker on it. So there's a lot more room for that. But you can also see that the teams plan ahead, you know, with their helmets or a computer company are doing that. DS, you brought up Lenny Martinez. I thought that the way that Bahrain Victorious did his kit was super tasteful in that he had his team shorts, but they did the leg bands with the polka dots, and then he had the gloves and the helmet and the socks and all that. I thought it actually looked pretty good. Sometimes for me, I mean, even you're talking about white, right? Like, world champion, you know, Vanderpool rocked a lot of white, a lot of Kopecky rocked a lot of white, and Pogačar when he was in the world championship stripes. I am not a fan of the white shorts. And then it's interesting, you know, look at Tim Mellier in the European champion jersey racing. It's got the bands across the chest, but it's kind of hard to tell between him and the young rider jersey. Where you see with other teams, you know, they make them not. You can't wear. Visma doesn't wear yellow, right? EF doesn't wear pink during the Giro because it clashes with one of those jerseys. Just one more thing on that. I would argue that when four years ago, when the green jersey went to that, like a darker, more the Skoda green, or I don't know what it was, I still liked it when it was that brighter green. The bright green. A few years ago, yeah, I think maybe when Wild Van Art won green, it was a brighter green. It was more of like a Sierra Nevada pale ale green that just popped a bit more.
Yeah.
I do like the metallic finishes that Trek's doing on their bikes. Milan's like green reflective bike. I think that looks pretty cool.
Yeah.
And then when is too much? What do you guys think about Ben Healy? Man, when he came out in yellow, it was like, it was everything, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if he had yellow bottles on his bike as well, but it was like, holy moly, man.
A little too much yellow for you, Cass?
Just a little, yeah. But you got, I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's just personal preference.
Yeah, that's everybody's style, right? I think I've seen some kits that even though it seems like it may have more items, for some reason it ties together a little better. And then other people, it seems like it's just more color is their only idea with it, you know, not necessarily the style of it. But I think it's a little bit on a case by case, you know, depending on how they rock it.
I don't think that I saw actually the Instagram videos or social videos of Ben Healy's yellow Cannondale arriving in a Porsche, which I'm like surprised he wasn't arriving in a Cadillac, which I think is an amazing sponsor for that team, by the way. But, you know, the other thing I was thinking about a little on the jersey colors is I feel like I remember something in the Giro or something where sometimes somebody doesn't necessarily want to be in the white that day because they'd rather wear their fancy custom designed skin suit versus the event sponsor, the race sponsor's skin suit. So, you know, if they know the time trial is coming up, they might back down on their white jersey standing or one of their standings so that they can wear their own super special suit for the time trial. The tour suits, you know, they look pretty sophisticated, but I'm not quite sure how all that works. I know that, you know, Lance brought Nike on to the tour so he could wear Nike the suit that was special for him, but
yeah, I think for time trials especially, just because you're in that mode, like you can see a guy when he's on his time trial bike and he's in his position going and something about it doesn't look comfortable. He's like shifts in the seat real quick, you know, wiggles his legs a little bit, shifts the chamois. I think for the skin suits, it's probably just the comfortable feel and the familiar feel if you're used to your team shorts and how they ride and sit. The last thing you want to do is like time trialing for the yellow jersey and have the chamois riding up in your crotch or being uncomfortable. One less thing to think about.
Yeah. Well, and then that brings us back to, you know, you had said you heard something about that bike being delivered special there. You know, I think the original Tour de France fashionista, you know, back to Cannondale, was it Cipollini? He was like the guy in all yellow, right? Yellow bike, the Cannondale. I think he wore yellow shorts and got fined because back then you could only wear black shorts.
Yeah.
And that was brilliant. Like, yeah, we'll pay the fine every day because it was bringing that publicity. But I think, you know, love him or hate him, I mean, the guy, he definitely brought some showmanship to cycling that wasn't there before. And I mean,
he brought moose to race day, hair moose to race day.
Yeah. Well, sure, it was a special mix, a little moose, a little gel. Yeah.
Yeah, but definitely the flair of that. Yeah, like I said, I think it's good, man. If you're good enough to get in any jersey of any tour at any time, any grand tour, then you should be celebrated because that is, you know, that's a career accomplishment. I mean, somebody like Tade, I think he's about to break the record or maybe did this tour for total number of days in any jersey combined. But, you know, for anybody, that's still amazing to even have one day in a jersey. So I say, man, if you earn that right to put it on, then, you know, you get to juice it up.
Yeah. I mean, it's just all opinion. It's just like black shorts or colored shorts, you know? For me, I said, I don't, any color shorts are fine as long as they're black. Yeah. And maybe navy. Especially in the rain.
Yeah. Yeah. All right.
I noticed also some of the, like, you know, Tade might have a yellow computer, for example. I'm not sure I've seen him with a yellow Wahoo, but just say he does. He might, you know, later in the season still be riding with that yellow computer. Just a little reminder, like, you know, I was in yellow this summer and I still have my yellow computer on my bike. It's kind of like a subtle little, nice little marketing, you know.
Yeah, just I like
a friendly reminder to his competitors about how he just throttled everybody.
Yeah, that's right. Just don't forget that beating that you took.
So what about the, you're speaking of Pogacar, Ed. What about the pink glasses? Seems like he's always got those high-vis pink glasses going on.
Yeah, I know that brand, whatever it is. It just doesn't speak to me. I can't vibe with his pink shades and that brand. And like when he's on the podium and it has this, the logo, I'm sure Oakley probably does this, the bold logo for the podium shots, but just keep it subtle. You know, we all know what brand it is. We know. Don't shout at us, you know. So I just like the subtleties and the subtle marketing of sunglasses, and I get like a little turned off by Tade's shades.
If there's only one thing maybe you could fault him for, Tade, it's the shades.
That's just preference, though. You know, I remember like helmets and sunglasses are the most coveted piece of material in the rider, because anytime they're shooting the rider's face, you see the helmet and you see the glasses. So that, I mean, that makes the most sense. That with a, you know, going off on a little tangent, but I like it. It tells how much money Red Bull must have put into that team that Specialized gave up prime logo space on their helmets for the Red Bull logo on the helmet, because, you know, they've always really done well with their logo placement. And that's the whole thing. I mean, you remember Specialized did glasses for a while because they didn't want to give up to Oakley or Bollé or whoever it was, because the shots are always in the rider's head. So, you know, I think it's a constant battle there. But a lot of interesting stuff, sure.
Well, KS, you bring up the logos. When Specialized rider's got his head down, the S is straight on the top of the helmet looking straight at you. You'll notice the S is on the thigh of each short, straight at the camera.
Yeah.
And then if they win, it's on the backside of the front, you know, the palm of the gloves, if they're wearing gloves. I'm always surprised at how many young riders aren't wearing gloves anymore. I know it's cooling and that your hands represent an area that you want to keep cool to keep your body temperature, core temperature down. But there's some marketing on those gloves when you raise them in victory.
And there's protection when you go down.
Yeah.
Because, we have seen a couple of crashes. I'm pretty surprised that there aren't more riders having problems when they crash without gloves on, because there's nothing. I think I crashed without gloves once when I was probably 15 or 16 years old, and it was like having burns on your hand, and you couldn't hold on to the handlebars, let alone ride on a bumpy road. So, to each their own.
And when you're bringing up the logo placement and it showing up on the TV screen, my time in professional golf was to calculate for the sponsors how many impressions the name on the hat was going to get,
right?
And how valuable the hat was. And the bag was secondary in value. And so I would prepare these reports to try and solicit sponsors for the professional golfers that we were working with. It would just show the number of impressions. And so that Specialized S on the top of the helmet when the head's down is, you know, that's a lot of impressions on screens around the world and now on social media.
Yeah, they do and I noticed that same thing on the helmet and even afterwards after the finish. I would say that they do probably the best job of just having a easy, clear, recognizable logo that's in the right spot on their clothing, you know, how they affix it, you know, what are the areas that they've obviously checked it out, been in the studio, looked at different camera angles, checked video and see the areas that show up more often and definitely put their logos right there. They do a great job at that.
And they've done a great job of keeping that lightning bolt S logo too, the paint mark S.
Yeah.
But it's like, that's part of it is that brand recognition, you know, like the swoosh of Nike or that same cursive Coca-Cola or whatever it is, or just the iconic Apple with a bite out of it. It is brand recognition, and they do a great job at that.
Yeah.
It was fun this weekend sitting around watching the tour with you guys and including with your mom. That was a lot of fun for me, and she'd be like, "Oh, what jersey is that?" And so one of the things that we all noticed is that, you know, MAP is now in cycling and they're the Alula sponsor for the Australian team, and you got the French teams kind of all looking the same, and Lidl Trek really pops, you know, they pop out on the screen. They remind us all of the Via Claire in the 80s and 90s. It really stands out on the screen. And it's, you know, there's a lot at play with the color and the style and how bold the jersey is. You guys have any comments on the jerseys you like or what speaks to you?
I noticed the one that I thought was interesting. We were talking about the Israel Premier Tech jersey. And when they're coming for you and down, you know, it's got a yellow and red. And I noticed that one side of it was yellow and the other shoulder was red. And it reminded me of the
yellow with
the Israel Premier Tech.
Yellow on theirs?
Did I say yellow? Yeah. Oh, my bad. Blue.
Okay.
Sorry. And red. My mistake. Yeah. The Israel Premier Tech, blue and red make the point. And when they're bent over, you see, you know, and coming at you, you see like a red shoulder and a blue shoulder. And it reminded me of the look of the old Motorola jerseys, which were red and blue. And interestingly enough, Steve Bauer, who raced on Motorola, is the director of the Israel Premier Tech. So I don't know if that was just by chance or he thought red and blue was good and offered that opinion in. But that was something that I noticed about it. I tend to like a little bit more of like, I guess maybe the trends of the jerseys have done it where there were like ombre fades and all sorts of different things before, and then it comes back around. Jayco's is a bit more, you know, like patterned, but I tend to like stuff that's a little more solid colored would probably be my only preference, you know, that where the colors are and in the jersey that you can identify them pretty quick. So that you can tell, you know, who the riders are from the helicopter shot or wherever.
Yeah, as I was saying, a helicopter shot versus a head-on shot versus a side shot. I find that the more, the easier it is to see. You know, interesting, when I first, like, had to design a race team jersey for the 2004 Sierra Nevada team, and I was like, oh, what colors do I do? You know, and I was working with Joe Parkin when he was at Castelli and back and forth, and I was like, why don't I just talk to the photographers? And so I remember talking to Casey Gibson. I'm like, hey, Casey, what do you look for? Like, what colors stick out and what do you look for when you take a shot? You know, and we did that first jersey and it was in that pale ale green. That's what I said. I said, if you can pick a jersey out easily through the viewfinder or from a distance, are you going to shoot that? And he said, yeah. So that was kind of, you know, something I did, you know, very unscientific, but at the same time, you know, we got a lot of shots, or it showed up in a lot of shots. If you see the whole gamut of, you know, a big Peloton shot from the side or even from the front, right, what sticks out sponsor-wise? Because the commentators are going to also call that stuff out as well. So there's a lot with it going on. But I'm similar with UDS. I like the blocks and the harder lines versus the fades. You know, I've done both of those in jerseys. And it seems like it goes through phases. It seems like for a while everyone had a blue jersey.
Yeah.
You know? And now it's kind of gone away, but
yeah.
And we know that everyone's trying. We know everyone's trying to match their sponsor, and so Little Trek stores probably look, you know, the sign looks just like the jersey,
right?
And so they're lucky that it also pops on TV. We all commented. We looked at the Red Bull jerseys this summer, and they look like candy stripers or a lollipop or wrapper. I mean, I don't understand it. It doesn't speak Red Bull to me. I know that they want the helmet to still pop because they still have a lot of brand identity around their helmet, but they just look like candy stripers. They weren't strong, and it's not bold enough. But maybe when Remco arrives, he'll have his design input.
Yeah, we'll find out August 1st.
Yeah, man, that's like the Grinch that stole Christmas. Every time I see that jersey, it's like those little peppermint candies that you know, with the little cellophane twist thing that sit at the doctor's office. Is like, yeah, I don't know. That one is definitely strange. It kind of reminds me of like a club team trying to make a pro jersey with someone that thinks they're a designer. I think probably of all the jerseys, that's my least favorite. You know, not having really thought of it until right now, but. But again, just opinion. Tell us what you think in the comments. You never know. Everyone has an opinion, right? And the internet's a great place to be somewhat anonymous.
Yeah.
If that's what you want.
So we have an idea for a new weekly segment that DS is going to kick off because he's going to really drive it home with his story. So tell us the new segment, DS.
All right. So we'll take you back. We're racing the Tour DuPont, which for those of you who don't know that race, it was a predecessor to like the Tour of California, not the same company, but it was our national stage race. You know, it was like a 10-day stage race on the East Coast, 1992. Phil was on Motorola. Phil Anderson, it's another interjection of a Phil Anderson story, but you'll hear why. So we're a couple days from the finish. I can't remember exactly what stage, but we took off, and you know, and in context, you know, the European pros would come over and race a race like that with the U.S. pro teams. Of course, because they were from Europe, they always thought that they were more of the top dogs. They would, you know, kind of try and police the pack a little bit, or, you know, when maybe you're setting tempo or not, and kind of interject their flavor, which rightly so, you know, they did know a bit more. And so this one specific stage, we start out, and it wasn't like a technical neutral start, but we started in some small East Coast town, and we were kind of like rolling out through town, you know, left and right and left and right, you know, and we came into this one section that like came in, and there was like a little town square with a park in the middle. And so the center was like four-sided, and it had hedges all the way around, and the road was on the outside, but it also had hedges on the other side. So we came in, I think we turned in and made a right, and then went a left, and we're riding along, you know, and everybody's just kind of like cruising, taking it easy. And all of a sudden the Russian national team, one guy on the Russian national team, like goes for the attack and just comes flying up the inside of the pack to clear it before making this tight corner. But it was like not even a normal size road around the park. It seemed a little bit narrower, and he goes flying through the corner and just misses the corner and up against the hedge and high sides and like flips over the hedge. So he like disappears over, and we're all like, what? And Phil rides up and just pulls over, sits up, hand on the top, and just shaking his hand like in good Italian, and he just goes, amateur, like that. And we were just all cracking up. And so when I was thinking about some type of a segment, I thought that we have a new segment, which is called the amateur segment. And of course, if you bring up an amateur move, you have to say the amateur with some real flair. So if we see something that seems like a bit of an amateur move, we're going to have to call out the amateur move. Yeah. So that's the segment. I have my first one that I'm going to nominate. As we were watching the tour stage yesterday, stage 20. And Miro Schmid was leading the peloton in some type of a super tuck and just came around the corner and just crashed himself and just slid out, lost the back end, and, you know, flew. And luckily, he was okay. And amazingly, everybody behind him hit the brakes and was able to get around him, and nobody else crashed. But if you're at the front of the tour and leading in your super tuck, you may want to come out of the tuck so you don't end up crashing out in front of TV. So that was my amateur move. But I will say, as a bit of a savior to him, he was seen later back at the front hammering and pulling and setting tempo for his team, who had a bit of a lower GC battle going on. So he did definitely get back up after his amateur move and save some face. Yeah. So that's the amateur for this amateur week.
And yeah, I would say yes. The amateur tour isn't just cycling. It's anything in life when you make an amateur move, right? Somebody who's had some time doing whatever you're doing wouldn't do it. So yeah, amateur is amateur. You know, DS talked about that DuPont. Back then we had national. It was before there were pros and there were amateurs, where now it's just elite, right? So we did have national teams racing with the top European professionals, you know.
Yeah, which is great, because he was actually an amateur, not just an amateur move, but it was actually a licensed amateur.
Yeah.
Which is why it was so good.
one could argue that the Eastern Bloc countries were all pros anyway, right?
They were.
Yeah.
They were all pros. And those guys that you were racing against then, they had been here for the tour of Santa Barbara and Redlands, the Red Locomotive Army or Red Army or something. They had a name. And those guys all went on to, Berzin went on to win the Giro. I think he ultimately tested positive. I assume he still holds that title. But did he win the Giro?
He won the Giro. I don't think he tested positive, though.
He won the Giro and beat Miguel Indurain.
Then Bobrick won the Tour of Lombardy 1 year. They were all on that Jewis team in the early 90s. So they were definitely had some firepower going on.
Well, that team, yeah.
As the records show.
Yes. Yeah, I think Dmitry Zhdanov might have raced for Panasonic. For Panasonic, although Ekimov wasn't on that team. I think he was the generation just ahead of those guys. Like him and Kianishev were a little bit older. They had already turned pro, but the amateur tour.
All right. Yeah, so that's our that's amateur.
Yeah. I'm going to self-nominate myself for an amateur. I recently have been riding an XCO bike with a lot of technology and a lot of buttons. And You know, I'm a left-handed person, and I'm also probably quasi-dyslexic or something, you know. So I forget my buttons, and I'm dropping my dropper when I'm supposed to be shifting, and I'm locking out my fork when I'm supposed to be shifting, or my seat's up when it should be down. And so I'm getting better at it, but there's a lot of amateur moments when the seat is in the wrong place or coming up a little too fast or something. And you know, time on the bike fix those amateur mistakes. Also, the one thing I would talk about amateur is when we were all growing up, we held ourselves to a higher standard, which I think needs to be around a little bit. Like we would ride each other pretty hard and make sure, one, you weren't late for the ride, two, when you showed up traveling to the races, you had your shit together and you weren't an amateur. You know, you had your food, you had your gear. You could take care of yourself. You weren't going to be late.
Weren't relying on other people for your stuff, your necessary items.
That's right. I mean, that was before amateur, but we did have the nickname of Rely because, you know, we had a buddy that always would forget shit and would rely on other people. As I say, modern day, don't make your problem my problem.
So make sure your seat bag, you don't rely on other people for your seat bag. So maybe tonight, crack it open and see what you got in there so you don't have any more amateur moments.
That's right.
Well, I think, you know, sometimes at this point we tend to kind of tease what the topics will be coming forward. I think that, you know, we've floated out a few things that we haven't covered, so maybe we won't. You know, you get the general themes that we're going to cover. I mean, is there anything we want to tease going forward, or we just let we sit today? We had a coffee meeting for an hour where we worked out our topics for today. We want to be fresh. We don't want to be redundant. We don't want to be like every other podcast. So we welcome your feedback. You know, so please send us your comments, things that you'd like to see us talk about and cover. Is there anything last minute thoughts you guys like to share?
No, I think I said it. I think I got it all out, fortunately. I'll probably remember it all right when we hit stop.
I mean, I think not for this one, but going forward, I think there's definitely more of a discussion about the bike handling and the crashes and what's really causing the crashes, and also what's allowing riders to get up from crashes versus getting carried away in an ambulance from crashes. Because I think that I mean, there's always a factor of luck, a little bit of that in there. Although, if you really think about it and say you make your own luck. And I think that's something that we can, you know, go into more, especially now with the camera work is so great at these events. You know, we can find this stuff, we can share it with you and you all, you know, our listeners, you can go and find this stuff yourself and really look at it. You know, like I said, the camera work is great now. So there's an abundance of that stuff out there. So I would like to, you know, I think talk about that a bit more because it's not just all about how many watts you can push. Because if you can't stay on your bike, it doesn't matter how strong you are. So,
100%.
So we really value your comments in the comment sections down below. And you can email us or DM us on the socials. We're a Service Course Report on Instagram. We're on Substack, where we get Darren and Kurt to write an article on something unique there. So, you know, sometimes stuff translates better in the written word. I'm getting tired.
He's blasting from the ride yesterday still.
And he only had one coffee.
Yeah, that's it. Needed a second.
So we want to tell everyone for hanging with us in our outdoor studio. You know, Darren's been holding the umbrella with his left hand the whole time. I've been holding the microphone. Hopefully there's not too much feedback. Bear with us. But we really appreciate your likes, shares, your subscriptions, and, you know, welcome your feedback on what you'd like to see us talk about. So take care and see you out there.
All right.
Hey, don't hit stop yet, because if you look, we're actually all here together, right?
We got all in one.
We got to get it as camera. We just couldn't figure out the last camera. So
There's my
Anyway,
yeah.
Old dude's doing tech. This is awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Wind noise and barking dogs. See you guys.
Okay. Thank you.